I thought that I would choose today, instead of the traditional either doctrinal or exhortive subject, an entirely different perspective, in a sense addressed to students of the college, and more or less indirectly to anyone else who has a responsibility in the work, or, thirdly, those who are not directly employed at all, but who have a responsibility in life toward the work. That should include everybody. And I would like to give an illustration today of 30 years experience with the worldwide, or radio as it was first known, Church of God, in terms of functions within it and opportunities that do come our way, what one can learn by reflecting back on years of experience and opportunities that are quite different from what one would have expected merely coming to college as I did in 1947, which was then 2.5 years or 2 years after the two phases of the Second World War, one in the European, the other in the Pacific area. If I were to tell you, which I should like to, some of the opportunities that have been afforded the people whom we've met, to give you an idea of the state of the world today, and in a sense what has happened in 1968 till now, with our contacts that began then in Europe, I think that you will see that in many ways we had opportunities and were being prepared one way or another in the remarkable arrangements that have been made, especially those Mr. Tkach mentioned coming up yet this year and next year in the Near East and Europe for Mr. Armstrong. Now, we all have different opportunities. I can only tell you that there are some things worth sharing that I alone have experienced. There are other things worth sharing that you alone have experienced. But this is my day in court. And so I will tell you some of the things that God has done and made known and enabled, let's say, me to experience so that I am better able, hopefully, to evaluate material and to reflect upon what our staff writes in 1980 by having contact both with peoples and places that go back over a 25 or more year period. The first 4 years of the college were not true college years because during the first three, we had either one or two or three academic years. And the fourth year was the first time we had the fourth. And in that sense, the first time we really had a program that began to reflect a full-time institution. It was a year after graduation in 1951 that Mr. Herbert Armstrong wished that Richard David, his older son, and that I should have a chance to visit Europe. We were perhaps less mature in certain areas, let's say, than Mr. Raymond McNair and others. I did not come with the same kind of background, let's say, that some who were reared in the Church of God Seventh Day did, and Richard David Armstrong was always perhaps the more reticent of the children, and in a sense, I didn't have the Bible Belt experience that Mr. Raymond McNair did, who's now your Deputy Chancellor here, and he had the privilege, and others, to go on baptizing tours that I did not in 1951 and before. So that Mr. Armstrong thought, perhaps evaluating our future roles, that there would be things for us to learn, and he wished us to visit Europe, which was then but 7 years after the close of the Second World War. And so we visited such countries as France and Germany and Italy and Yugoslavia. I want to tell you a little bit about the state of mind that one would find in 1952, the state of affairs, in contrast to today, and to see what changes had taken place step by step. It is hard to believe necessarily, unless you yourself have either studied or seen pictures or heard those who tell the story, what remarkable changes have transpired not only there in Europe, but in the whole world in this past quarter century. This is probably the period of greatest change that has ever occurred in human experience in terms of the upward mobility of vast numbers of people from the countryside to the city, and the decay of morality at the same time from the city into the country, and the expanse of technology such that it would be hard to believe some of the descriptions I should like to leave with you that enable me to understand better the states of mind and the state of affairs in nations that our news bureau deals with or that you would read. Our first visit, of course, was to France, and we spent quite a little time there because Mr. Dick Armstrong was very interested in French. And, of course, this was a critical period in French history, then France bearing the burden of Western Europe in the struggle with communism in Indochina and the struggle for liberation in Algeria and North Africa. And France was in a very tortured state. In a sense, one could say that the countries of Europe were at peace as a result of the crisis that came to an end in 1945 in May. But France was actually at war. France was in a state of war almost entirely from the close of the war in order to maintain its empire, which it in fact lost. At this time, also in Luxembourg, as we traveled from France to Germany, we had the chance to see what a little country was like that, in a sense, could put up no resistance, that had the opportunity to develop technologically as much as a small country might. It was certainly an advanced country, not damaged in the same way as parts of France had been, and as we would see, Germany was. Mr. Dick Armstrong and I could walk perhaps one-sixth of the country in one afternoon. We did not do very much driving there. We walked because the country is so small. And that was an experience to be able to feel you had sensed much of what a country is like by actually going on foot. We visited a fair, and at this time the United States had a great propaganda program going in Europe. It told us an untruth, that the key to the success of the United States was technology. We failed to realize that technology alone has made no country great and is likely to ruin many. This country is based, whether we like it or not, on the capacity of the land to produce. And this country would be great whether or not we had all of our technology. And with it, without the ability of the land to produce, we simply could not be where we are today. This is a gifted country. No land in the world has such a remarkable area for farming as the Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio drainage area. You look at its placement in geography and compare it to any river in the Soviet Union, which delightfully flows to the Arctic, in contrast to the Gulf of Mexico. You contrast this to the Amazon basin and the forest swamps, and you will understand the difference. There was a man whom I knew to be German, who was representing, of course, Luxembourg at the fair, and Luxembourg has people not only of Belgian, but of German and Spanish descent, if you know something of the area. We were speaking wholly in English, and as we departed, Dick Armstrong and I gave him a parting word in German. And for the first time, I saw what the German nation really must have been like. Because when he heard me say goodbye to him in German, he turned around in a very special way and clicked his heels. I found him to be more German than the people in Germany, because he was not in a vanquished land, but a man who still inherited the traditions of his past. It was not until we crossed the border that we saw what really had taken place, for in Trier, Germans were still knocking 7 years after the war mortar off the bricks in order to build. We were to, some days later, visit Berlin, and I had never seen the pyramids, but there were two or three pyramids in Berlin made up of broken brick rubble to be used in construction that in 1952 were larger than anything the pharaohs of the third or fourth dynasty ever erected in Egypt. This was the rubble of a single city. This was 7 years after the war. You want to think of how long a time this is. We've heard many stories, we've written them up, but it is important to realize that even as late as 1952 in the summer, there were only American vehicles or European vehicles made outside of Germany. There were trucks of German origin that the army had had, and there were pre-World War II automobiles, a very few. 90% of all the traffic was strictly truck. Almost everybody was hitchhiking. The automobiles were, without any question, either belonging to nobility or certain of the wealthy, or in general were utilized by Americans who were over there and simply could afford to buy or rent such vehicles in the country. It was a land that showed nothing of the symptoms that we now do, except that people went to work early and they got home late and they did not walk slowly to work. We could see them from 6 o'clock on going to work, and that was a sign for the future. Italy was quite a different situation, always more delightful. As any German would say, you want to celebrate the victory with an Italian, not win the war with them, but celebrate the victory. And this was, without any question, something of the spirit of Rome, which I have always enjoyed. I have never been flustered by the traffic of Rome. I've always felt it reflected something of the nature of a people that you learn to like. It is possible to have your luggage in a taxi in Rome, the taxi driver singing an aria, going round the corner and off comes the luggage. So he stops his aria, gets out of the car, puts the dented luggage back on top, fastens it again, and we drive off in the spirit of Italy. Now, this was quite different, of course, from the austerity that one might have seen in Germany. But Italy was very, very limited in contrast to anything we know. Yet, I would say Italy reflected a certain level of accomplishment because, in a sense, it had changed sides in 1943. And it became one of the powers that were on the victorious side in that war. It was not until we went to the city of Trieste, where we found, of course, the conflict between Italy and Yugoslavia centered, that we began to see something that we had never seen or experienced before. For when we entered Yugoslavia, there was a country of drought, there was a communist state, west of the Iron Curtain, in one sense of the word, yet very communist in another. This was a land that had been under the control of Turkey for centuries. It did not reflect the culture of Catholic or Protestant Europe. It was not, in a sense, a part of Western Europe. It was a part of the great Balkans, and I had never seen anything that would remind me more of what the period of the 1860s in the United States at the time of our Civil War must have been. There probably were no more than 5 vehicles that we would call automobiles that we saw in the entire country on that brief excursion. We went by rail, and people were compacted. The countryside was suffering drought, and in the city there were soldiers, we might call them policemen, with guns and fixed bayonets at every major corner or intersection. Nothing like this in Germany with the Americans. Nothing like this in Italy. Nothing like this in France. This was not an occupying power. This was Yugoslavia ruling Yugoslavia, that part that had become a member of the Communist Party. And the picture that we have of communism then is so different than we have of the picture of communism in Eastern Europe today. then it was possible for a party simply to control by brute military force. The ticket collectors on the train were always followed by a soldier. In fact, always accompanied by a soldier. When we had our monetary currency change made, and we had the evidence to prove it, two soldiers would follow, in a matter of minutes, the exchange and inquire what was done and how we got the money that we had. Everything was supervised by the army or the police, and everything that the army or police supervised was in turn supervised again to be sure it was done, that no one did other than what was required. The city was remarkable because people came in from the countryside, not as in Germany on bicycles or hitchhiking. They came in wagons drawn by horses. And in the heat of the day, the people did not go to motels or hotels. They slept on blankets beneath the wagon in the shade, in the main streets of what was once a beautiful city, Belgrade, in the time of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, just before the First World War, and of course during the interim period when Yugoslavia had become independent. This was a revelation, and it was an insight into the Middle East, which we should not then fully experience, but a recognition that it was possible for a country in the very heart of Mediterranean Europe to be less advanced in 1952 than it was in the days of Paul in AD 52. There was no real advancement. In the Roman days, people traveled in carriages and there were speedy horses. These were farm animals and these were farm wagons. The Romans would have found it unbelievable that the beautiful Adriatic coast of Yugoslavia should have been less advanced in 1952, 19 centuries later, than when Paul was reaching European Rome. But that was the state of affairs. What is today in Yugoslavia, as you could see in any picture, is so different that it is perhaps best compared to a visit with the moon and then the earth. We had the chance also to visit Berlin. I referred to the pyramids of rubble. At that time, it was possible only to drive in the no man's land between East and West Berlin. It was not safe to go any further, no indication that we would come back. It was some 5 years later that Mr. Armstrong wished to have the then managing editor of the correspondence course, Dr. C. Paul Meredith, whose training had been in veterinary science, to have him and me travel in portions of Africa and the Arabic world, in the Near East, in Europe, for Dr. Meredith's education, partly because I had had the experience already in Europe, and partly because there were growing demands by the magazine. And so it was that we had the chance on this occasion, now 10 years after coming to the college and 6 years after graduation, to visit such countries as Belgian Congo, modern Zaire, where Pope John Paul II is now visiting, and you should follow the spirit of reception that is occurring on these very days in his present tour of Africa. We had a chance then to visit Egypt and Afghanistan. And I was very pleased that that was my one and only time to visit Afghanistan, because it gives me a much better understanding of the background and the state of affairs. Now, as students, you see, we cannot all travel as widely as perhaps my experience has been. But what you do with your travels, whom you meet, and how you make use of your opportunities is very important. It was in New York. Coming from the airport, we had to go downtown to pick up our passports. In so doing, we normally take a taxi. Taxis in New York are expensive, and many Jews who live there know that. And so one of the Jewish community asked, "Is there anybody else here who wants to share a taxi?" And Dr. Meredith and I volunteered. We had a trip arranged through Nigeria, Congo, through Khartoum to Cairo. We really didn't know very much about it. No travel agent knew very much about what lay in the heart of Africa. When we got into the car, we were explaining to the gentleman where we were going. We asked him what he did. Well, he wrote travel books about Africa. This was probably the most remarkable coincidence I have ever experienced. Now, he was flesh and blood, very much of the house of Judah, not an angel, but he was sent by one, without a doubt. He explained to us in each of the countries in the heart of Africa where we must go and what we must do and see. And we changed our entire trip to meet the needs. As a result of this opportunity, and it was indeed a remarkable chance to have met a man of this nature at this moment. If we had decided not to accept his offer, we would never have known. We did visit Kano in Nigeria. This is the Muslim part of Nigeria, quite a contrast to the southern part where Lagos is. There I came to be acquainted with African culture as it is reflected in Islam, as distinct from Christianity. This was the first time I saw Islamic black schools. These black schools are approximately, and you may not believe my statement, they're approximately the size of the top of the podium in front of me. Now, they're not what you think. They are, in fact, a place where one or two children may sit all day with no teacher. This is a little different from our local school. I see here some individuals who are responsible. These little schools in Muslim Kano, which is the heart, and a crossroads. This is where you land when you come from Europe and cross the Sahara. These little schools are visited by teachers who make the rounds of the city. It would be hard for me to imagine American children with a little blackboard in front of them, copying from the Quran, writing on the blackboard, without a teacher much of the day, but the teacher comes round from time to time and offers explanation and watches your progress. And the people are walking by here and walking by there. And this is just a little corner at a thoroughfare where two streets cross. And almost every place where two streets cross is a little school that is no more than a place where you may be protected from the hot sun from above. There are no walls. And we could stop in and watch the progress of each of the children. There was no hooky being played. This is education in this part of black Africa. It is so different from us, from our thinking here, that we would have to say that there was something greater in the culture that made it possible for this kind of education to succeed. Here, where students want to get out of school, there, where students wanted to learn. Here, where we have all of our technological facilities and teachers, there, where you had none of them, except an itinerant teacher who made the rounds every day of these little schools in the city. In visiting the Congo, we of course first were in Leopoldville, where we had a chance to become acquainted with the impact of the Belgian government. It was apparent immediately to Dr. Meredith and to myself, less than two and a half years before the revolution, that the Congo was headed for one. When you came to the country, you sensed antagonism in the air. There was no question about it. And unlike the way the British did, the Belgians simply had not prepared anyone to lead. The Belgians took one extreme, the British took the other extreme in methods of education. The British method tended to leave the women uneducated beyond maybe 2 years. And that day, maybe 4 years later. And the men could go all the way up to be trained as lawyers, barristers in England. In the Belgian Congo, nobody, a man or a woman, was ever educated beyond grammar school. So there was really no one to take the lead. Neither system was successful because the one kept sending the young man in the British area back to the bush for a wife, and the children had to be educated all over again because the mother was not educated. In the Congo, no one seemed to have been beyond what we would call. Now, there were rare exceptions, perhaps, but in fact, no one but more than three, if my memory serves me correctly, had ever been afforded the opportunity of college education, three individuals in the Congo. at the time. And the country was ripe for an explosion, which did occur in January 1960, less than 2.5 years after our presence. We had a chance in flying across the Congo to see the countryside and to travel over Shaba province, which is quite famous today. It's an open forested area. You will know, of course, that this has been significant in some of the recent struggles that have occurred in this part. It is a mineral-rich area. In flying over, we were aiming at the region that we call Ruanda-Urundi, which was the heart of German Africa before the First World War. Now, we had a blessing in disguise. One of the engines of the plane was malfunctioning. It was a two-engine plane going over the heart of Africa. I knew it. I don't think anybody else. My eye happened to have caught a malfunction in the engine as I looked out of the window. I didn't take it seriously because in those days we never dreamed that there would be any problem we could not surmount. Some of us have dreamed differently since and failed. We had 3 extra days as a result of this because the engine had to be brought in from the Belgium itself and flown all the way to the heart of Africa. There was no other way to repair the plane. It had to have an engine completely replaced. We had, therefore, 3 extra days. This was at the courtesy of Sabena Airlines. And we had an experience that none of us have ever had before. And I would just like to relate what opportunities can arise. I had not known, nor had the gentleman who had discussed matters with us in New York known, or if he did know, we just never got to it, that the Belgians had developed in Ruanda-Urundi a very remarkable experimental farm for the production of tropical fruits. It was an experimental farm to see what fruits would produce and be found marketable and palatable. And so we were given a tour on one of the days of this experimental farm. I was able to understand something that most people never would. It's one of those lasting memories of what God did when He created vegetables and fruits in different areas of the world. I tasted and I saw what I have never seen or tasted since. It happened to be the time when the trees were ripe. And they were most remarkable reds and yellows and greens and flavors that can hardly be explained. They were sweet and sour, and often sweet and sour at the same time. Many different varieties on the experimental farm, and within 2 to 3 years it was all to come to nothing, because everything that the Belgians had done would be brought to nothing in this area. The great river boats on the Congo would stop, be tied up, and the water hyacinths would multiply, and the boats would rot. We traveled down the escarpment, which is the greatest escarpment in the world, where we in Ruanda-Urundi could look west over the Congo Basin. And we got down into the basin, and there, of course, I had my first introduction visiting the Afei pygmies. This was a truly worthwhile experience because it made me prepared to play a role within the church on behalf of Jean-Pierre Allais, who himself, in this very year of 1957, when Dr. Meredith and I were there, he was living as a pygmy among the pygmies for 1.5 years to learn their language, their way of life, languages, their way of life, their culture. These were the most happy people I had ever seen. These were people who had long ago decided that people who are happy with their land do not have to fly above in planes, but may walk peacefully beneath the trees. The blacks around them thought differently. They wished what the white man had. And so the blacks around tended not to be happy, and the pygmies were supremely happy. I was introduced to their family, to their families, their children, asked to visit their geodesic dome houses, which even the pygmy does not stand up in. He never has a reason to stand there. He prefers to sit in the house, so you don't have to build it any higher. That will enable you to sit. My method, of course, was to recline, and I occupied most of the house when I did. But it was really something to be introduced to a man, or several men by the leader or the chief of the migratory tribes, to meet the children, to hear the little music that they would play on their bamboo instruments, to see their way of life, their cooking utensils. It was like meeting people who really hadn't strayed that far from the Garden of Eden in their makeup, in their mentality. Now, I will stop for the moment and say, we have an article in the Present Plain Truth which poses the question in terms of treating the elderly, why is it that countries that either have multiplied the Bible or claim to know more about the Bible or the Bible's God or the Bible's Messiah seem to mistreat their elderly or take less concern of them, despite what is in the Bible, in contrast to people who have never had it? I pose the question, is it possible that God has had to speak to some through His written word? Because if He had ever left the civilized world without the Bible and had given it to the primitive people, would we ever have survived in our society? These people had to be brought the Bible. But all I can say is, having met many backward peoples of the world, I'm impressed at how much less they lost than the people to whom the Bible has been an heritage for centuries. A family life is truly remarkable, and I could have said the same thing had I never heard of Jean-Pierre's comments. Since I had spoken in Imperial Gymnasium on the subject of Egypt and my visit there, I would only like to say something briefly here. That was at the time of the visit, I should say, of the present president of Egypt to Jerusalem. So I will not address some of the remarkable experiences I had in that country, but only to say that we had the chance to visit the Coptic people who were in Upper Egypt in the area of Luxor. The book dealers, this was now 1 year after the crisis between England, France, Israel, and Egypt over Suez. And I visited the bookstore there where the Coptic book dealer had obtained a number of the libraries of the British who lived in the area and had to leave the country hastily. And when I entered into the shop, the most remarkable thing was to see that the shopkeeper was reading a book in Coptic. He was not there, of course, dealing with much trade because there were very few tourists. Our guide, a man whom I will always highly respect and certainly want to meet in the resurrection, his name is Salib Hanna, who was a Copt and highly respected in all Egypt. He introduced me to the book dealer, and the book dealer was reading the Bible. He was reading the Bible in Coptic. He was, in fact, in our discussion, anticipating the return of Jesus Christ to set the world straight and to deliver the Copts from their Muslim neighbors. Here is a people who knows more about the real meaning and the significance of the return of Christ, who are not really a part of the mainstream of Western Christianity. I felt more comfortable with them than I would in the Christian world that we know here. They were concerned with the plan of God. In this country, there are other and divisive concerns, which is very sad. In Jordan, having gone to Syria, we drove through Jordan to come to Jerusalem, then under Jordanian control. We drove in a taxi. We were stopped every 5 miles by the Jordanian army because there was trouble in Jordan between the Palestinians and the Jordanian government and the Bedouin, and we met roadblocks and had our passports regularly examined. It was an unusual experience. We had the chance, once we were in Jerusalem, to visit Samaria, and en route back to Jerusalem, we stopped by the Samaritan community and had the chance to visit the high priest of the Samaritans, who was then living in 1957, who since died. My impression of the Samaritan community was exactly what Nehemiah would have said. These people were, or Josephus said the same thing, these people were in general Gentiles. But when I looked at the priestly family, I saw the house of Israel. Without any question, the priestly family that does in history trace its roots by a renegade of the house of Levi that went to the Samaritans. You read the book that Josephus wrote on this subject, you read Nehemiah, who drove this branch of the family out, that the priestly family has as its tradition roots in the tribe of Levi, as distinct from the bulk of the population, that reminds one of the peoples of lower Mesopotamia. We did go back to Syria, and there we found the luggage we had left where we left it, in the hall corridor in the hotel. Nothing was lost, nothing was taken, everything was safe, because Islam does not allow the kind of thievery that we know of in much of Latin America and in the Western world. Can you imagine leaving a country, leaving your luggage behind, taking only bare bones things in a satchel, going to another country, Jordan, and then coming back and find that your hotel had kept your luggage in general public display with no problems, no thefts? I think that is worth saying in a period of conflict between Islam and the West, that we need to look at all sides and the state of mind of people. It was many years later, in fact, it was in October 1978, I came back from the excavation and I was in Damascus, Syria. And I stopped at a hotel and I realized when I got there that I did not have enough money to stay there that night. It was the last day and I normally would sleep in an airport in a crisis like that. And I thought, well, maybe they'd take a credit card, which he did not. But he knew I had stayed there one evening before going to the excavation that AICF is assisting in on the Euphrates. He suggested to me immediately, he says, look, he says, you stay here tonight. You don't have any money. We don't use credit cards. What you will do, and we don't want a personal check because we can't resolve that here. What we'll do is I'll pay your bill. And when you get back to the United States, you pay me. This is the man behind the counter. This is not in New York. This is not in Los Angeles. This is in Damascus. And if you want to know, it's the airport hotel. I saw no reason not to take him up on it. And I sent him a check. Now, I know, of course, that he was wise enough to have me address the cashier's check to his home address so he could negotiate. But that was all right. That was his reward. It was interesting. I checked next morning to see that there was nothing that had gone wrong. I asked about the bill. The new man behind the counter looked at it and said, it's all paid. And there was the money. He put the money and everything was right. And he relied on me. This is the Syrian people. I want you to think about that. This is the other side of life. We have people who don't understand between peace and war. I think Americans conceive of themselves as a peace-loving nation. We don't conceive of ourselves for what we are, a nation of thieves in many ways. We see the Middle East as a people whose sense of war and violence is not at all governed by the Christian teachings of Jesus, but whose sense of honesty, not only in 1957, but 1978, is still the same. That is my own experience. In contrast, I would like to say that it was only two evenings ago that our son, who is meeting with the rest of the family in the gymnasium, was driving to meet someone in the evening, and as he was passing through an intersection, his back window in the car was shot out. And that evening in the hill cities here and in the area of Sun Valley and Pacoima, 88 cars had their back windows shot out. That has been reported to the police. And that was at the time he went to the police to have it checked to be sure that it was brought to their attention. This is the United States in 1980. We are a peace-loving people, but how we live with each other is quite a contrast to some other nations. Afghanistan, we later visited, essentially the city of Kabul. It was a remarkable city that reminded me of the 1890s. The Americans were there in force, building dams at the cost of a few million dollars to assist in the agricultural development of the country, dams in the countryside that people normally would not see.
The Russians were also there. They were paving the streets of Kabul for $10,000. Everybody saw the paved streets. Everybody thanked the Russians. We had to have our passports presented because we could not stay in the country more than 24 hours without presenting ourselves. We met the Afghans at the door and turned our passports in to the man behind the desk who supervised the coming and going of everyone in the country. The man behind the desk in 1957 was Russian. Does that tell you anything about 1980? We will skip the rest of our trip until we come to Kashmir. We had gone to India and flown to Kashmir in the typical Indian fashion. You fly straight up of the death of Ali, and in this case, we are dealing with the same sect in Kashmir that is in control in Iran today. This is not the mainstream Islamic sect of the Arab world. In fact, a sect has occupied the areas that are non-Arabic in this part of the world, and the mainstream of Arabic philosophy is a minority in this area. Hence the present conflict over the Persian or Iranian embassy in London is between the mainstream Islamic Arabs in Iran and the sectarian Islamic state that runs the non-Arabic Islamic country. Iranians do not traditionally fall into the Semitic Arabic world. Americans don't know the difference. Iranians speak a language related to India, Western Europe. The language of the Arabs is related to the Hebrew. That's the simplest way for people who don't understand the distinctions. This was a day when there was to be a celebration, and it was the close of the fast. And the men came to visit the mosque, and the women followed them. These people do not act as other Islamic people. The men were stripped to the waist, and they had belts in their hand, and fastened to belts were fragments of metal or glass. And they beat themselves in the back and in the front, and in the back and in the front, as they marched through the city, hour after hour. And it was a bloody sight. And the women, though not stripped, were certainly very lightly clothed, and they beat themselves like this with their fists, and you just could hear it. And this went on and on and on. And I won't continue further. It was something so unusual that I did write a very extensive letter that was read back here at the time. I'd never seen asceticism in the Islamic world take on this form. But it will explain to you much of the spirit of the modern revolution in Iran. Remember, the Ayatollah himself comes from Pakistan, the present leader in the country. The area belongs to India because the prince is Indian, though the bulk of the people are Islamic, and it is a sore point between India and Pakistan. It is now, at this point, not a critical matter, but significant nevertheless in any potential future rivalry between the two unequal countries. In 1963, I had the chance, after having the doctor's degree here given, to go to Israel just to indicate clearly that it was possible, despite our most limited doctoral program, to be accepted in postgraduate work then at Hebrew Union College, Institute of Archaeology. Nelson Glick was then president of this branch of Hebrew Union College in Israel, which was beginning. It was a wonderful opportunity to have the chance to participate in an excavation under Moshe Dotan at the city of Ashdod in the Philistine plains. I had the chance, of course, of meeting a significant number of people, both as lecturers and who were there as young men doing significant academic work in their fields. A Hebrew lecturer from the Cincinnati home campus of Hebrew Union College was there, and his wife, and I, Greenberg, and others, Weinberg was this man's name, and his wife, and I was perhaps more attracted to them than I was to any other faculty members. They had essentially a German culture, having been in Germany, in Poland at the time,
of the Second World War. I would only like to tell you something that Mrs. Weinberg told me as we sat one time among in the group, but somehow they talked more freely to me and I felt like talking more freely to them. She was on the last train to Auschwitz. And it was stopped en route. And they were ordered out of the train by the Allies that had come and cut the tracks. They asked her, among others, if she knew what lay at the end of the line. This was in the winter of 44 to 45. She had not known what Auschwitz was. She had to be told what would be meeting her there. Because the Jewish community and many other peoples of Europe simply were not allowed to know what was occurring under the Third Reich. Until, of course, the camps were opened and the world saw what slave labor was. But it was interesting to see the state of mind of a woman who had survived and escaped at the very end on the last train to this remarkable camp in Poland that the Germans ran. They had become Reformed Jews in America. She had known something of our teaching because I explained some of the things we believe, and she happened to have picked up some literature of the Church of God Seventh Day that was in circulation over there, and she brought it to me one day and she says, "You know, this is very much like what you teach." I agreed after looking at it. I didn't say anything further. I didn't feel it was a need to identify with that, remnant of the parent sequence to this work, which refused to grow and, in a sense, expel the live branch of the church then in Oregon in 1938. But I had a chance to ask Dr. Weinberg on one occasion, what is it like as a Reformed rabbi, which he was, to eat unclean meats? Well, he said, your conscience troubles you if you've been raised an Orthodox Jew. I thought it was an interesting word to pass on. His conscience troubled him because all the reform did not resolve the law. Now, there are people, of course, who might not do this, but he told me that he was troubled having to become a Reformed Jew in America, as he viewed it, rather than to remain strictly Orthodox, as some do. It was in 1966 that I was privileged, along with Mr. Schnee and two others, one of our staff for many years here and one of the staff members in England, to visit Eastern Europe at the time of the assembly in 1966 of the Prehistoric and Protohistoric Congress. I will not discuss the significant individuals we met or our experience in Czechoslovakia, but I would like to tell you that when you travel behind the Iron Curtain, you learn to do things that you don't otherwise do. We had the privilege in Romania of staying not in a hotel on one occasion, but in a private home. Now, in Romania, there were simply not enough hotels or motels, and by this time, the country was prospering to some extent, as all of the world was. It's almost a decade and a half after my first visit. But it was possible to learn something of life behind the Iron Curtain. You see, all the private homes in these countries were retained by the people. Now, if they wanted to sell them, they could and turn it over to the state. But if they wanted to keep it, they certainly could to the time of their death. So that many people had private homes and were able to live in them, and this man offered his home to guests and tourists, and we communicated in French because he did not know German, and he did not know English, and this was our basic solution. The home was quite cramped. By Western standards, it wasn't that large. It certainly was a kind of country cottage. But in terms of the furnishings,
here in Romania, and undoubtedly in the private homes in Yugoslavia, a country that looked 100 years behind the times on the outside, undoubtedly in some of the private homes that were left, people still had some of the most beautiful furniture that you would see, comparable to any of the estates in Pasadena. This was an indication that the 1800s and the earlier 1900s in Europe did not lack, even in the Balkans, a sense of art and a sense of taste. And it was possible to accumulate, for many, a certain minimum amount of wealth. But the war as a whole and the tragedies that beset this part of the world made the externals of communication extremely backward. Even in Romania, it was very backward in 1966. Very backward. The countryside had no automobiles except foreign license plate automobiles. We met in this area of the world our first gypsies, and I realize, of course, what home life among gypsies must be like in cases like this. Hitler attempted to exterminate the gypsies as he did the Jews. Gassed the Jews and castrated the gypsies and gassed them. He didn't want nomads wandering around, and this was his attempt to purify Europe. Some survived, but their home life is miserable. The men shouted at the women, and they shouted insults and threw things at each other. It was not a very balanced society. The children would come up and immediately offer things that were obviously of little worth to try to get money. And they still live by the same methods that their ancestors traditionally have always, and that is by hook and crook. They claim to be, and I see no reason to dispute them, the descendants of the priests that were expelled from ancient Egypt. In 1968, we had a very fine privilege of beginning to make contact with King Leopold of Belgium. Mr. Armstrong, of course, has told the story. Mr. Rader has. The man who knows it best, of course, is Mr. Frank Schnee, because it was merely accidental that we made this contact, for Mr. Schnee was looking for an address, and the policeman in Germany could not tell him where the address was. And a man who overheard the conversation came up to Mr. Schnee and said, "Afterward, I can tell you where the address is. Let me show you." These are my own summations. This man, as it turned out, became and is one of our most staunch friends in Germany. He was also in the field of photography, and one of his friends was the Belgian photographer who was the personal friend of the secretary of the King of Belgium, Leopold III. And that's how our whole worldwide sequence of events began, because Mr. Schnee, like a good German propagandist, sent a copy of the envoy through this man up the channels, and finally it came into the hands of the king's secretary, who thought the king should see what this remarkable private college is, at which point the king said, "I should like to meet its president." And you know the rest of the story. I was privileged to go there to look at some of the slides that the king had made of his trips, and for 3 days I had the chance to visit him. My wife was along at that time. She herself felt quite comfortable in his presence. I was much less so. It's hard to say why, but one wants to be very careful before a king. He was taller, and he was also known to expect that you didn't make social mistakes. He did compliment me on the second day for having been very careful and in no sense ever having let a single slide slip from my hand. He noticed that, and I saw to it that it didn't happen, as I knew he would notice. We went to lunch, and there I met the treasurer of the King of Belgium, who handles his financial matters, and we discussed the morals of Ambassador College. And the treasurer posed an argument. The king did not take great issue, but wanted to hear what I had to say. Was not at all impressed by his treasurer's comments, it appeared. His treasurer said he saw no reason why there should not be prostitutes before young men are married. I explained, of course, that we don't have that kind of standard because we hold out marriage to be so significant that its goals and its purpose transcends any cost of self-denial before marriage. These are my words today, but I'm summarizing a rather lengthy discussion. And I said, of course, one cannot merely say, no, you don't allow this or that, unless you put something positive in the student's mind as an aim, as a goal to achieve. And the king well understood why we could succeed. But the treasurer's view really reflects why there is a prophecy in Revelation 17 that there is a woman who is the mother of all sorts of prostitutes and whores. Because the system says you can't do this, you can't do that, but offers no alternative goal to replace human drives and just simply allows and tolerates the consequence of illicit behavior. So this was quite a discussion we had, and I think it was important from a, not Mr. Armstrong's point of view, but for the king to have the point of view of someone who was a student who went through our educational system and who could see why it worked. It's one thing to hear what Mr. Armstrong has to say. The question is, does it work? The answer is, when we don't follow through, it doesn't work. When we do follow through, as today, it does. And I would like to say that I very much appreciate the quality and the character of leadership on a daily basis that Deputy Chancellor McNair is able to give, and he's reflecting on the campus here, the responsible leadership in this particular critical area that we had, of course, and that made the campus in Bricketwood so beautiful so many years. Now, not every one of you shall meet the king. These are not always opportunities. However, many who were students did because the king spoke at the campus here. On one of those occasions, a friend of mine, a man whom many of you know of, spoke to the king in French. And when he visited the campus, the king, of course, did not recognize him. And later that evening, I intruded into the king's presence before a musical program. And I asked him if he knew who the man was who spoke to him in French. I said, he is a man who, in the Second World War, saved the lives of more than 900 people. And the king marveled, because there were very few at that time who would risk so much. A man who could understand that ordinary people could become heroes. The king of Belgium is a remarkable person who treats us with great respect. As a result of events, we also had the privilege of introducing ourselves among the Israelis. And in December 1968, I had the privilege, along with others of our staff in England, and Mr. Armstrong from here, and Mr. Rader, to have lunch at the Knesset, and in the Knesset, which the Jews, who are secular, look upon as the holy place. It was meant half serious, and of course it was half biblical in the sense as they saw it as in some way having as close a presence to the power of the state as if one were to dine in the holy place just outside of the Holy of Holies in the temple. We had the chance that evening to meet the president of Israel. I sat also next to Yigael Yadin. And we had a remarkable discussion with a number of the men as we finalized our arrangements to assist in the archaeological work and in the many other things of which I've played no role. But I've happily had this initial privilege and to know these individuals and to discuss some of my own experiences with the president of Israel as he sat while the others were, and I was at his left. Mr. Armstrong was at his right. I think that was the way it was arranged, and then the rest of us were around. And what was most interesting is that the house of Judah was on one side of the table, and the house of Joseph and a few Gentiles were on the other. It was very interesting to see what peoples were like. And Mr. Armstrong was on the side of the house of Judah. I had also, as many of you know, the opportunity in 1967 with my wife to visit the Soviet Union. I should like at this point, since the afternoon is drawing on, for you to go back to the material that Victor Kubik and I worked out at the end of 1967 and in earlier 1968, if you'd like to understand something of the experiences that you would have in the Soviet Union were you to visit it, and that is the best way, since we do have copies in the library, for me to comment. We had a chance also in 1971 to visit Thailand and to assist Mr. Armstrong in evaluating the nature of the King's project and our possible assistance role. The King was not in a position to say to Mr. Armstrong that he needs money. We did talk at length as to the nature of the program. I met some of the Royal House. I hosted a luncheon in the hotel room where I was responsible, in which some of the women of the Royal House and educators of Ksetsart and Chiang Mai University were there. One would say that the King wanted us to know what was required. He wanted us to know that the government was not doing this, that the King himself had to, because the government was not concerned about incidental hill people or the opium trade. He was, and certain significant cooperative educators. So as we had a chance to fly the military helicopter and be with the prince and walk through the tiger-infested grasslands of the hill land, there are not many tigers, we didn't see any. The only evidence would be the tiger bones and the rice whiskey that we were served by the hill people, on which no tax was paid. The meat was off the bone, by the way. The bone was in there to give added strength to the whiskey, because, you know, a tiger is strong and his bone must be strong. And so that is the way these people think. But it was marvelous to have the chance to see these people and to realize that the King had rightly envisioned the solution to a problem, and that in the end what was needed was not to present to the King what should be done, but rather to offer an opportunity of assistance, because he already knew what should be done. And his program, I have cited on a number of occasions, in the Thai community has in itself learned more about the King's program as a result of what I have said on two occasions to the assembled community, one as a fundraiser here in Southern California and the other at the Thai temple in a cultural program one Sunday afternoon, than they have known from their own presses. And that strangely also includes the information that the present Thai Consul General did not have. I am surprised that their presses have not done more to make it known. It was in 1975, and I will close. There are always other sides to the coin when you have responsibility. I was asked to visit Southern Africa, and en route, I visited our brethren in the South Pacific. And this was about the time of the Feast of Trumpets to the Day of Atonement. And it was on this occasion that one of the women, a mother of one of our members, Mr. Fungalei's mother, he's in the Department of Agriculture, was brought home from the hospital because she had dengue fever and was not expected to live. In America, our custom would be that we would put test tubes here and there, and we'd try radiation, we'd try this kind of therapy and that. Friends could visit family on occasion. You would be otherwise in a sterile bed, and you would die with all these things attached to your body, all of the implements of modern scientific medical technology available to you as you descend to the grave. In Tonga, it is different. Once it is known that you will descend to the grave, you are released to go home, to enjoy the presence of your relatives and their company and care. Mr. Fungalei asked me to visit the house, and I came there. This woman was a Methodist in her background. It was about 9 in the morning, and her little house was made of coconut. It was, in my judgment, somewhat like 7 feet wide and 12 feet long, and one door on one side. And her cousin was there, and I was asked to come there, and she was on a tapa cloth bed on the floor, and the floor is the bed that's on the coconut floor that's on the ground. And you can stand up in the center, and you duck when you go in and out. It's a one-room affair. That's how they live. So I held her, and for 3 hours I had the unusual experience I let her rest herself against me, and I became a kind of pillow, and I held her, and we talked a little in English, and they talked a little in Tongan. And by that time, of course, not every Tongan word was unfamiliar after you spend many days, and you go there from, this was now my third visit. And she gradually became weaker and weaker, and her cousin folded her arms, and she became weaker, and she died in my arms, and her cousin closed her eyes. I should stop there.